Resonance Rewind.
With Robin Pierce, Jessica Burtis, Eloise Sheehan, Jenny Bill.
And every so often, some delightful guests from the cosmos. Ooh.
Overall, I like this script very much. Although there is not much action, I believe the script is interesting and the relationships of the characters will work very well. The roles delineated will provide a challenge to our actors' abilities, which should heighten their interest in the piece and their subsequent performances. Not my words, but the words of DC Fontana when she was script editor, of course, for the episodes that we're going to be looking at today in Resonance Rewind, which is why is one of the reasons we've got our very own Dr. Trek himself, Larry Nemeczek, with us. Return to tomorrow. Running. So in terms of the actual summation thing, Robin, a very, very brief summation of Return to Tomorrow before we get into the meat of the matter with a positive squad of folk. We've already mentioned Dr. Trek, Larry Nemeczek, of course, Star Trek writer and general Star Trek guru. We've got Phil Leonis, ace director, who has been doing lots of research for this very episode and doing a whole stack of things as well. We have our usual Resonance Rewinders, Jessica Burtis, Jenny Bill, and Eloise Sheehan, and making her debut on the production, also probably new to the Star Trek sort of ethos and certainly Resonance Rewind, Rebecca Bond. Robin, tell us about this episode, quickly.
Okay. I'm going to cheat then. I'm going to just read from Gary Gerani's fantastic television and tell you that Return to Tomorrow, despite its misleading title, nothing to do with time travel, okay? The bodies of Kirk, Spock, and a woman doctor played by Diana Muldaur, who would return in season three's Is There in Truth No Beauty, and Next Generation, season two as Dr. Pulaski, are inhabited by the minds of an advanced civilization that intends to build robot bodies for their brains to live in. And there you go.
She'll just briefly just contrast Dorothy Fontana's views when she was noting the script, because of course the script editor actually changed his name as well, or changed the whole thing, by Robert Justman's line, who also said when he was writing to Gene Kuhn, "I think we have in this script a perfect example of how to take an interesting idea and completely screw it up. If you are looking for a way to force our most rabid fans to transfer loyalties, I suggest that you have found it." So it may well be controversial. Let's turn to Larry Nemeczek first. Any initial thoughts on Return to Tomorrow?
No, my first thought about Return to Tomorrow is it's almost like still, you could say, for 50 years and maybe still, you could say the quintessential line about all Star Trek is risk is our business, comes from this episode. And that almost trumps the episode itself now, because that's like, that's just your perfect soundbite for what is Star Trek about. But no, it's a fun story because it does the, you know, it's like a mirror episode. It lets all the main characters flip, and or at least three or four of them and a guest star flip and do, you know, a different character. It's an exploratory show, but it's a bottle show. It actually gives Nurse Chapel a decent role. I mean, those are all the things that bubble up and come to mind. We almost forget about the fact that we're talking about the old, maybe the oldest sentient race discovered across any Star Trek is mentioned here, with the cute little, you know, spheres and the cute little cubicles somehow. And so the exploratory aspect is strong there, aside from just some of the, and it's a showpiece actually for even more than William Shatner's Kirk. It's a showpiece for Leonard Nimoy and Spock and being the seductive villain there. So yeah, that's the, and yeah, and Diana Muldaur is wonderful there in the first of her three times to appear in the series, all the series, and yeah, it's just yes, I have no qualms with it. It's the story of how it was made and how the original writers took his name off of it because he wasn't happy with how it evolved is something that's to me only just come to light the last three or four years, but that we covered on my podcast, The Trek Files, once, but. You know, it's in there. It's a worthy entry to the Star Trek pantheon.
Yes, there was lots of litigation which we could go into, but let's turn to Jessica at this particular moment, because Jessica, slowly but surely, across the centuries, we're working your way through all 79 episodes. I think this is the fourth of the 79 episodes you've worked through. What are your thoughts on Return to Tomorrow?
I had originally, from the title, I thought it was going to be something like time travel, some kind of Mary thing, but I actually enjoyed it. It was a little, there was a lot going on. There was a lot happening, especially with all the body switching and who was who and all that happening. But I thought it was very beautiful at the end. I really enjoyed it.
Kirk dies and Spock dies. Rebecca Bond, mm-hmm. Your first show. Is this your first experience of Star Trek in our continued passion to ensure that the word is spread even in the 21st century?
It is, surprisingly, it actually is. My parents both love it, so they were quite shocked to know that I'd never seen it before. So yeah, I watched the very first episode, so season one, episode one, and then obviously worked my way to, not all the way through, I must admit, to Return to Tomorrow. I really enjoyed it. I think it really represented 1960s culture attitudes, which was quite a interesting look back as well. But yeah, I really enjoyed the episode. Like Jessica said, it was very beautiful. I loved the ending. And there was a lot of twists and turns, which keep you on your seat. So I loved it.
Yes, as we said, two deaths. Or are they death? Or are they just going into oblivion? let's turn to Eloise then. Eloise, welcome back to the programme. Any quick thoughts from yourself before we hand over to our Norwegian representatives, both literally from Norway and from Los Angeles?
Hi, Alex. Yeah, it's actually only my second episode I've seen due to the show. It's the first episode I've seen that's actually quite spacey and what I expected. So I really did enjoy it, especially the cinematography and the lighting that went along with it. I'm going to watch more due to this episode. So.
And indeed, as has been commented for the benefit of the listener, Eloise has even lit her room in a Star Trek 1960s style just for this particular line with the purple sort of violet background. Very impressed, really. Jenny, Bill, any thoughts from yourself?
Yes, this is, I really, really enjoy this episode. It's actually, I mean, I think it's quite a low budget episode, and it's a great testament to the acting that I think the episode is really great, really holds up on its own and doesn't really use a great deal of special effects or sets or aliens in costumes or anything like that. It's just a really great script and really great acting, and I really think it's a great episode.
Thank you.
looks as though it's getting thumbs up all around, especially if you bear in mind that it's set in the year 2268. And indeed, Sargon apparently was a Mesopotamian king who actually ruled in 2269 BC. So a nice little synchronicity there between 2268 BC and 2268 AD. But it could all actually end in tears now, because we're going to hand over to Phil Learnus. Phil, your thoughts on this particular thing. Is it like Larry, that speech that resonates with yourself?
What resonates with me now is the fact that the story will take place in my 300th birthday. That's nice. I have something to look forward to. And how much fun to, by the way, be talking about this the day after the great Richard Arnold dies, the wonderful mm-hmm. Star Trek archivist and keeper of the flame in many ways. I got to share something with you. Words slipped out that I was going to be doing this show, talking about this in a little chat with some of my listeners of Chilpak Hollywood Hour. And nothing I have done, including the show they listen to on a weekly basis, has left them more excited than the fact that I was going to be talking about this. Because to a person, they all talk about how this is the perfect embodiment of the classic Trek ethos. Though, I think, Larry really is on to something, that it's the speech. They remember the speech as embodying the classic Trek ethos, though I do take exception to him saying that it trumps the episode only because I don't like hearing the name Trump. But
sorry.
It is interesting when you pull away that element, the ethos of Star Trek, something that I have talked about with some of my colleagues who also teach acting, is that it's an episode about acting, not just one based on great performances that displays great performances, but it's literally about the process an actor goes through. Think about the way that a character finds you. You don't seek out the character. It calls upon you. It needs you as an actor uniquely to embody it. And then the bravery, the courage, the risk. There is risk in availing all your vulnerabilities, availing your entire body to this character that wants to inhabit you. And you open yourself with integrity and literally step aside and let what wants to come forward, i.e. the expression of that character, flow through you. It's really fascinating to watch that episode through that light. And if I get the chance to be handed the microphone again, I want to talk about the work of the director specifically in terms of the performances he got, because we don't talk enough about directors of television. It's thought of as an actor's medium, but in film, we often refer to the director as the author of the movie, the auteur, because even when they don't write it, if you look at their body of work, there's a through line of themes. This is certainly true with director Ralph Senensky and his Star Trek episodes.
And indeed, I think Ralph Senensky wasn't all that happy with this, according to various lines. I don't know, Larry, if you've heard anything in terms of he felt that actually it was overacted in certain ways. He felt as though certainly the McCoy kind of torture right. scene wasn't really working. He generally sort of felt, I think, unhappy with it, possibly because he had to do the whole thing in 5.5 days.
Mm-hmm. Late second season budget rush. Yes. Crunch, crunch.
He Robin. Makes up for it, though, by going over schedule and over budget on the Tholian web, which gets him fired off the Star Trek series.
Which wasn't his fault. It was the damn stupid
of course. Yeah. Of course. Yeah. But I like that he was determined to take his time and right. to do it right. And they remove his name from the episode. And yet they used every yes. ounce of footage that he shot. I would just throw this out there for people to consider. He had done This Side of Paradise, one of the great episodes, mm-hmm. Tholian Web. I mentioned a through line where we see an authorial presence there. They all are unique riffs on the Kirk-Spock-McCoy dynamic. They all involve Kirk utterly alone. This Side of Paradise, Kirk isolated on the ship. Mm-hmm. This episode, he's isolated in the ether the unknown ether. We don't know where he is exactly when he switches bodies with Sargon. And in the Tholian web, again, isolated out off the ship in ether in a ghostly state. And as a result, all three of those episodes afford Leonard Nimoy wildly welcome opportunities for an actor to do something different.
Yeah. And with more time to do it in, because Kirk is absent.
Robin, did you feel as though it floated your boat in terms of an overall piece? Because we know that you're not an Assignment Earth fan, but that's another issue, as we said.
Well, actually, controversially, if anybody was to ask me what my top three or top five Star Trek episodes were, this would be number one. I think this is the best they'd ever did on Star Trek in a single episode, more than City on the Edge of Forever or anything like that, the usual suspect, because everybody gets a decent, meaty amount of screen time. And as Phil said, it encompasses the ethos of Star Trek perfectly. If anybody was to ask me, right, what's the one episode of Star Trek I should watch that will tell me what this series is about? I would say Return to Tomorrow, because you've got the ethos of exploration and you've got the essential humanity and the potential loss of humanity and humanity regained. You see a fair amount of the USS Enterprise itself. You've got your typical indoor planetary set, which is obviously, you know, tinfoil sprayed. It's got one of Kirk's best ever speeches. He's got that halting robotic walk. It gives, just for a change, Leonard Nimoy a chance to chew the scenery a little bit. It's, to me, it is absolutely perfect on every level.
Interesting words. Jessica, you'll be listening to Robin. Any thoughts from your good self? I mean, as a relative newcomer, and as they just working your way through the process, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say it's number one in the list of all-time episodes, but what are your thoughts?
No, I completely agree. I think that it captured so well, you know, the personality of each character. Even though they were all bouncing around and they had different minds going on, you still had such a good grasp on what each character is like and how they approach different problems. I thought there was a bit of humor still thrown into the show, even though the topic was very serious. And I don't know, I liked all the little details, like Sargon of Akkad having his name be in this episode, or, you know, her name, is it Thalassa?
Thalassa.
Thalassa, meaning, you know, sea in Greek. I thought that was very beautiful and touching, and I think it kind of shows how Star Trek does details so well, from what I've seen.
And yet, of course, the notion that they ended up in oblivion was something that Gene Roddenberry wanted to put into place there, whereas the original writer, of course, had them just spiritually gathering dust around the universe and still out there. And of course, as we know, that basically the spirits of Thalassa and Sargon inhabited Lily Holliman and Phil Lynas, and that's where they are these days, clearly. Just a thought. Jenny.
Beep, beep. Me again. I can't think of a lot more to say. Being somebody that's seen Star Trek a lot of times, I find that it's hard to look at something freshly. I mean, I've seen, obviously, since I was a child, I've watched them many times. This wasn't an episode, if I'm looking back, I wouldn't think, oh yeah, that was a really great episode. But watching it, I actually realised what a fantastic episode it is. But yes, there are the sort of the usual suspects that come to mind if you think of great Star Trek episodes.
And you've got Nichelle Nichols screaming, which is interesting, which is, and of course, George Takei basically felt he came back from the Green Berets and there was nothing written for him and no sign of Ensign Chekhov, but there we are. Rebecca, as a newbie, what sort of highlights did you have from this particular episode?
I mean, going into it almost blind, like having never seen an episode before, it's an episode that made me want to watch more. It definitely was something that made me think, oh, like, this is an interesting concept. Let me see where they've explored other areas, because I think it does take the series as a whole. It does take experimental scientific discoveries of the time and put them into what-if scenarios. It does explore those possibilities, and I think that's really, really interesting. So, yeah, watching that for the first time made me want to watch more, so couldn't have done a better job, in my opinion.
You see, Larry, I'm still working on this commitment to actually opening things up. Much as you might actually sing the praises of Lower Decks, I got one little smile, just an offshoot, one little smile at the beginning of episode 10. That's all I shall say. And it was good to see Landrew back in there. That's all I'll say about that.
See, they surprised you. Could I ask Rebecca something real quickly?
Yes.
Rebecca, since this was the first Star Trek you had ever seen, or original series or anything from the franchise?
Anything at all, I must admit.
Okay, that's so amazing. I'm just curious, just living in culture, you've heard about Star Trek. I was just curious how finally watching an episode, especially the original series, how that confronted or contrasted with what you might have brought in, just thinking, oh, I know what Star Trek is, or I've heard about it. I mean, what were you surprised by, or you know, if anything?
I mean, it definitely lived up to how iconic it's made out to be. I mean, even if you've never seen it, everybody knows what Star Trek is, what it's about, and it lived up to those expectations and more. I think, like I say, the concepts it explores are so fascinating, so interesting. It's so well written, so well acted. It's perfect in every aspect. And for someone who's never really watched a particular great deal of sci-fi before, it roped me in. I was watching episode after episode after I watched that first one. Okay. So it lived up to every expectation, definitely.
That's amazing. We have, there's a whole generation of current Star Trek fans, especially from the Kelvin, since 2009, the Kelvin era, and now the Kurtzman era, and all the new shows coming out. And I've seen it in online comment threads. There are a lot of, and I'll say newer viewers, i.e. younger viewers, so many of them say, I've been trying to watch the original series and I just can only take five. They want to watch it. And I chalk that up to a generational, or just, you know, I want to say, have you ever watched Casablanca? Have you ever, I mean, I think that's just a lack of life experience, but it's amazing. There's a whole generation that's like, I'm trying to, I mean, I've come up with a list of original series episodes that I think might, like I say, go watch City on the Edge of Forever, what, you know, something, but there, it's the acting, it's the lighting, it's the style of the 60s that's getting in the way, even when they say they want to do it. And so it's heartening. You're obviously an astute young lady. It's heartening to hear you just dive in without all of that filter on. And I'm not criticizing anybody that does, because like I said, there are some really sincere people I've read trying to watch it. I want to say, give it 5 or 10 years, come have a kid, get married, come back and watch it, and a lot of these things will, for those people. So anyway, it was very heartening to hear your reaction
before we come to Phil Linus. I'll just move very briefly to Eloise. I mean, you're listening to that, you're also, like Rebecca, relatively new to the whole thing, because I know you're mostly a Doctor Who fan. Does that echo the sort of things that Rebecca was saying there with yourself?
Yeah, it did fit all my expectations. A lot of people that I know around me have always loved it, and I seem to have just boycotted it on that premises for some reason, just because I feel like I've been forced to watch it and I didn't want to. But no, it's like rather impressive, and it being quite modern for something I watch, having to see all the colours and all the lighting and everything that's so incredible in it, it's rather amazing that I stayed away from it for so long. So yeah, I do agree with it.
And of course, Jessica, it was really when you started off that term with me in the University of Lincoln that I said, you must work through this. Any thoughts from yourself?
I do think that coming on to watching this series, if you've watched like modern sci-fi, it is super different, just because I think a lot of shows are, even with how the camera is filmed, you know, it's constantly like changing shots, and whereas shows that are older, it's kind of like a bit more constant and sometimes more slow burn. I think that's an entirely different kind of enjoyment. But I think if someone's struggling to watch it, you just got to kind of get used to it, kind of train your brain to get used to the style it's filmed in, because it's just as cool as how modern sci-fi is done.
Phil?
Well, I was just reminded when Larry was saying that it was no different than the conversation when Next Generation came out. I still know so many people that loved Next Generation. That's how they got into Star Trek, and they still can't stand the original series. And yet the irony is, you watch those two series together, and in terms of the camera movement and the sets and the costumes, they have much more in common with each other than they do with the modern progenitors. But I had a really fun experience this week with this episode in particular, or I guess it was last week when I rewatched it. When I also watched the final episode of season three of Discovery, and I was transported. I did have a return to tomorrow, as it were, because I have a goddaughter who's 14 years old now. And the first time she watched Star Trek, she was little, and she was at my place. I was babysitting her, and she saw a Captain Kirk ornament on the Christmas tree. And I came in and I heard her just saying to herself, "He's handsome." And so I had to show her a clip of Trek. And what I showed her was the "Risk is our business" speech. And I then find out years later that she's watched all of the episodes online. Returning to this episode this week, you know, my goddaughter's 14. She's a girl of color. She has been on the receiving end of not an insignificant amount of racial hostility these past few years, when that became okay, apparently. And so I loved that in the same week I got to revisit my hero from growing up. Who was, of course, a cis white male, rampantly heterosexual. And here we are almost 60 years later, and my goddaughter gets to see a captain in Star Trek who looks like she does. And if that doesn't fill you with a little bit of hope, especially right now, and it certainly also returns us to what Star Trek has always done at its best, which is somehow express what is really going on in the cultural zeitgeist, and doing so in a way that lets us know this is all going to be okay.
Gene Roddenberry obviously likes his androids, and we've got various things, including the Questor tapes that we'll be considering in future episodes of Resonance Rewind. Larry, did you feel as though this was, again, another example where Roddenberry, who rewrote most of this, again, as we heard, mm-hmm. in terms of the script thing, was putting something together which was echoing his own views about the future of humanity and so on?
Well, it is, and aside from the backdoor pilot that's about to come down the pike here, with this is late second season, and that closes second season is Simon Earth. And a couple of years ago, my column in the official magazine, somebody asked me who actually wrote the "risk is our business" line. And it was interesting that this episode falls right at a crux time for the series, not to get too deep in this, but basically Gene Kuhn, who had fleshed out so much of Star Trek and, you know, so many things on the nose, had contributed from mid first season to late second, had burned out, had a couple of diffs with his friend Gene, and was leaving. John Meredith Lucas was coming in. He was a director. He was going to be the showrunner, basically, we'd say today. He was coming in, but he actually started with the episode after this, and they didn't have staffs. So this John T. Dugan, who had pitched this, it had sat from April until they were almost ready to shoot it as a story document. And all of that's why the teleplay credit is John Kingsmith. He not only, it wasn't just the fact that they had rewritten it, he didn't like what they rewrote. But the mystery of, like, who did most of the nuts and bolts writing in this script? It was Gene. He was the only one left standing to do it. And the questioner was saying, who actually wrote "The Risk is Our Business"? You basically are left with the assumption that it was Gene that wrote it. So for all the flack that Gene takes about, well, he's a great series launcher, you know, and he wrote the pilots and all this, he still had the chops when he could focus, sit down, wasn't on something, wasn't having somebody new in the office whoever was the affair of the moment. I mean, at the time, I mean, he really could still, you know, pump it out. And it's almost like this is the high water mark of the, aside from Assignment Earth, of him really being focused on a single episode and pumping it out. And maybe that's, I'm just sitting here kind of resonating. Maybe that's why it sticks with so many of us here, whether we've been longtime watchers or not. And, you know, even beyond the speech, that there seems to be a little bit of mature Star Trek.
I also like that it reflects something that I've seen in his writing and through interviews he would express this, but this desire that decision-making needed to be done by a team, as opposed mm-hmm. to all the heroism being driven by a hero. And that's the other thing about this speech is we forget this, but it begins with, we all have to agree to this mm-hmm. or we're not doing it. And I wonder, Robin, if that's one of the reasons that this holds such a place of affection for you, because that really stood out to me, this idea that the show sometimes didn't live up to, which was a real team. And yet this one really expressed it. We all have to do this together.
I think you're exactly right there, because a good leader will take the advice of his team. Something a recent president never did, of course.
He was just possessed by Henoch, Robin. Quite clearly, he was possessed by Henoch. Don't blame Trump.
That certainly gave this rewind great resonance. I mean, I am not joking. To watch this right the week of the inauguration and to see a leader saying, no, we all have to be on board with this.
I mean, that's the sign of a good leader, because yes, William Shatner played the swaggering, macho leading man that one would expect in the 60s. But here he shows, you know, a management mm-hmm. style that is still relevant today. But there is one aspect of this that I'd like to raise among the team that really, really makes the whole episode resonate with me, and that's the musical score. I mean, it's both sort of deeply sensitive and moving, and also soars at times. I think that's what tips this for me to make possibly the episode one of the best ever, because it's second only, well, no, it's just above the score that Mullendore did during season one, if you recall.
And George Dunning, of course, is the name of the composer who did the bulk of the work for this. Any thoughts on music, Eloise?
I'm going to be 100% honest. When I get involved in a show, I don't take any notice of the music. Obviously, I'd notice if it wasn't there, but I can't recall anything.
Yeah. Jessica?
I kind of agree with Eloise. I was a lot more focused on the sound of the different voices, especially Sargon's voice.
A little bit of reverb, Shatner with reverb. It's so much better than actually just having James do and lip sync the whole thing. And Rebecca?
No, I must say I did notice the music, actually. It's funny Robin brought that up. I did find it very cinematic in that way. I found the music really enjoyable and a real asset to the episode, which was something I did take away from it and have written down in front of me. So yeah, definitely agree, Robin.
Thank you.
indeed, we've been having aspects of it filtered through this particular episode. And Jenny, I know you like to refer to the musical aspects. Did it float your boat as well?
Yes, I did really like the music. And I think one of the reasons that they said that the certain aspects of the episode were really beautiful was when they brought in that love theme. Really beautiful piece of music. But, yeah.
Final word, of course, from Majel Barrett's character of Nurse Christine Chapel. Beautiful. And indeed, that speech, of course, do you wish that the first Apollo astronaut hadn't reached the moon? Of course, literally just 1 year after the launch pad disaster that killed the Apollo 1 crew. So again, and still some time before the Apollo landing actually took place. We have got to basically quantify the qualitative. So Larry, I'll turn to you first. A mark out of 10 for Star Trek Return to Tomorrow.
Oh, wow. I forget about it until I sit down and focus on it. I'm going to say it's not my favorite still sentimentally, but now that I look at it intellectually, I'll say a 9.
Yeah, I will go with a 9. Jessica, your thoughts?
Probably an 8. I don't think I enjoy it as much as the Tribbles, but it was still very good.
Yeah, if only they popped a tribble in there in one of those receptacles that wasn't destroyed. Keep a receptacle with a tribble in it. That would be the key thing forward. That's probably going to be
might have been
Star
one
Trek Lower Deck season 2. Anyway, that's another line entirely. Phil, your mark.
If I was just watching it standalone and wanting to review it, I would probably give it a 7, but I add an 8 because of what it says about the process of acting. I add a 9 because of how resonant it is now politically, and a 10 because without it, we don't get Eric McCormick riffing on that speech in Free Enterprise.
Jenny, we've reached a 10. Where are you going?
Mark
Altman. I'm going 9 out of 10.
Okay, Eloise?
I'm going to go for an 8.
Yeah, and Rebecca?
I'm going to go for a solid 9 as well.
And Robin?
Well, first of all, I'm just reeling that somebody else is as much of a fan of Free Enterprise as I am. And also, this, to me, it's a solid 10. No question about it.
There you are, this week's episode, which leads us neatly around to next week, which, of course, takes us inside and out. And inside out, to be precise, it's the animated Pixar adventure that we'll be looking at. But for the moment, Larry Nemeczek, special guest appearance, of course, today, and Phil Leonis, likewise, many thanks indeed. Jessica Burtis, thank you. Rebecca, thank you for joining us for the first time. Hopefully it'll be first of many. Eloise, good to have you back. Likewise, Jenny Bill and Robin Pierce. Keep on resonating.
Truck well.